Committee on Land Use for Wednesday, May 4th, 2005. Committee will not be hearing 3283. Today and on Friday, we'll be hearing a total of 15 bills, and this will clear the deck of all House bills that we have had in our possession by Friday, so that on Monday we will begin hearing Senate bills. So we will go right now. If we have not had a public hearing on a bill by Friday, through Friday, then that bill will not be heard in this committee. So if it hasn't had a public hearing by Friday, it won't be heard. So we will now open a public hearing on two bills, House Bill 3243 and House Bill 3244, both sponsored by Representative Ackerman, and we say good afternoon to our committee member.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from Legislative District 13, which is primarily North Eugene. I'm here to testify this afternoon on briefly on two bills, House Bill 3243 and 3244, noting that this is the first time, I think, that Measure 37 issues have been met by this committee, and I know the future is that we will be there probably very, very quickly. Let me briefly summarize each of these two bills, because they are a small but, I think, integral piece of the Measure 37 process. House Bill 3243 narrows the parties that of interest that can participate in a hearing under Measure 37. Basically, we limit the parties to the owners of the property for which the compensation is made and all public entities that are potentially responsible for the land use regulation. Why I have narrowed the participants down in this process is because Measure 37 specifically states that this is not to be a land use decision, it is not to be appealable to LUBA. As you know, in the LUBA process, anyone that has appeared at the hearing and submits an argument or a statement thereby can become a party. And what frequently happens in the LUBA proceedings is that the record is crammed with arguments and statements of neighbors and people that appear at the hearing. It makes the appeal process very expensive and very laborious. I contrast this narrow scope of persons that can participate in the hearing. I contrast that to a draft of the Senate Bill 1037 dated April 25, which again goes into the land use ideas of providing notice to properties anywhere from 100 to 500 feet from the property that's in effect. And then it also states under the Senate Bill that anyone that has submitted argument to the local entity basically has standing to come before the court. And once again, I think that clogs the court process with, I think, meaningful people, that people that perhaps are not totally necessary to the claims process, which I think should be as expedient as possible. I'm going to House Bill 3244. My concern was, what type of an interest do people have in property for which they either claim compensation or claim a so-called waiver? I was very, very impressed with the testimony early on, I think, in this committee from the title insurance companies and from the banking industry, that the title insurance companies would not know what to insure. They don't know what type of a claim this is against the property. The bankers did not know what type of security they would have if the property was subject to a 37 claim. I tried to cure that by providing that if a compensation exception is allowed and a person can erect their structure, that once that takes place, the compensation exception is extinguished, thereby allowing the party to presumably convey clear title to other successors. I also came up with another problem that there is, I think, good authority that if a person goes through the so-called waiver process, puts a structure on the ground, it could be considered as a non-conforming use. As a non-conforming use, it would be difficult to obtain title insurance and perhaps financing. So I figured that the legislature can probably do what it needs to do here, so I invented a term called a statutory conforming use, which that was the designation of land, if I would put on land, by legislation that had completed the construction process under a waiver option to indicate that we recognize that the use is now conforming by statute, hoping that that would help the insurability for title insurance purposes and for financing of the land or using the land as security for the loan that may be necessary to construct the structure which would be authorized under the claim process. So those are the high points of these two bills. I thank you for your attention.
Any questions for Representative Ackerman? Representative, we thank you for bringing the compensation issue in Measure 37 before this committee. There has been virtually no discussion in regards to compensation, and because we're having this public hearing today, we'll be able to bring this issue back and have a what I hope will be a very thorough discussion of it in the next couple of weeks.
I'm sure we'll be here.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Chairman.
We will close the work session. Excuse me, public hearing on House Bill 30. Oh, I'm sorry, we have some other folks who want to speak. Dave Honeycutt and Elon Hassan, I'm sorry. And Glenn Stonebrick. Gentlemen, good afternoon. I'll let Mr. Honeycutt lead off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The gruesome threesome has arrived. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in opposition to 3243, we'll take a neutral position on 3244 because there's parts that we like, but also parts of it that we don't. 3243, I would agree with Representative Ackerman that there is a tremendous problem currently with excessive appeals, but I'm not sure that 3243 is the answer to that. I think it paints with a little bit, it's a little bit of a blunt instrument. One of the things that we really like about Measure 37 is that when the local governments are making their decisions on what to allow and what on their process for handling Measure 37 claims, one of the things that they're doing is deciding typically either by ordinance or even more typically on a case-by-case basis as to which particular applications are going to be subject to a public hearing and which are not. And from there, with rights at that point of appeal based presumably on who testifies and who doesn't at the public hearing. And so if a property owner, if Farmer Jones comes in and he wants to put a home on his property and he can't because of a regulation that's been changed subsequent to the purchase of that land, most of the counties, at least that I'm aware of, are taking the position that that's a decision that can be made without the necessity of a public hearing. And of course then the rights to appeal would be limited to Farmer Jones and presumably to Farmer Jones at that point. On the other hand, if you're talking about some a type of development under 37 that would have some impact or involve neighboring property owners, or if a neighboring property owner wanted to, or the AG's office, for example, wanted to come in and make an argument that a particular applicant didn't qualify for some reason under the measure, they ought to have that right, particularly when we're talking about a bigger development. And so we like the fact under 37 that the counties have the flexibility to make the calls when and when not to hold public hearings, and think that the counties have been doing a good job of that so far. So that's why we'd oppose 3243. We understand the Representative Ackerman's idea and think that, and if this committee is going to take up the issue of Measure 37, that you put some sideboards on participation, depending on the type of claim that's being filed. But I'm not sure that we'd go as far as this particular bill goes. On 3244, we very much like the provisions of subsection 3 of the bill, but we are opposed to the concept because we think it's obviously inconsistent with Measure 37, at least as we believe the measure reads, of extinguishing the transferability with the initial claimant. The problem from a policy perspective, if the claim is extinguished upon the original, when the claimant subsequently transfers the property, then you're going to have folks, particularly in rural areas where we're seeing the bulk of the claims arise, transferring or developing their property at a time when they may not have wanted to develop their property. Well, one of the things that we like about 37, we like everything about 37, but one of the things that we really like about 37 is the idea that Farmer Jones, who may be 50 and want to continue to farm his property, can make his claim and continue to farm the property and then pass the rights to do something with that property on to his children, rather than having to develop the property immediately for fear that if he dies, that his claim is extinguished. This bill would essentially force people to develop their property immediately after they filed the claim for fear that if something happened to them, that the claim would be lost. And we don't, number one, we certainly don't believe that's what 37 says. And number two, from a policy perspective, since most of the claims are coming out of rural areas, if you want to maintain land in rural areas for natural resource uses, this is one way to, this doesn't do that. And so we like parts of 3244 a lot. There's parts that we don't like, and we're certainly hopeful when, if this committee takes up this issue, that there's a way to solve this, because I think there is.
Very good. Any questions of Mr. Honeycutt? Thank you, Dave. Elon, I have to confess, House Bill 3243 is the first time in this session the 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Oregonians in Action have agreed on anything. You both don't like this bill.
Yes, thank you, Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We also oppose 3243. I think because of the public process aspects of it, some of the things that Mr. Honeycutt alluded to. The bill describes claim for compensation is something that doesn't fit under, isn't a land use decision. I wouldn't go to LUBA. Problem there is that once the compensation is really the trigger for Measure 37, so the next stage after that is it becomes a land use decision. And then from that, as Mr. Honeycutt was saying, the neighbors who are part of that, who are affected by that land use decision, wouldn't have the opportunity to have any input in the process. And so those are the two reasons we oppose the bill and happy to be up here with Oregonians in Action on the same side of things. House Bill 3244, we support. It clarifies some of the language in Measure 37 by making once somebody develops, has a use, that becomes a legal use. So there's some clarity in that, which is useful. And then we support Section 3 also, which then curtails other uses that may come along down the line. So we think it's a good bill, and it clarifies how to work in a Measure 37, which is a good thing. I want to thank the committee for bringing up the compensation issue.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment that I understood the perfect compromise is the one that everybody hates equally. We may have reached that position on this bill.
That's a scary thought.
Mr. Stonebreak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebreak with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. I'm only going to testify on House Bill 3244. for, first of all, the first part was for the same reasons that Mr. Honeycutt gave on the transfer of these uses. But the main thing that struck my eye here when we talked about distinguishing this compensation exception is that I remember 37 is not only land use, but for other issues as well, other so-called takings or devaluing of property. And so I wouldn't want us to get into that frame of mind that, well, you know, if you request a waiver on your property and they grant it while you're for dwelling, but all of the rights are now extinguished. And there may be such things as wetlands or maybe, you know, harvesting of trees under the Forest Practices Act and so on, which also fall under Measure 37. I don't think they've been tested that much, but I wouldn't want to get into that if we've now extinguished our rights. And just one final thing, and I've just shared this with a few people, but if we're going to possibly do some remodeling, if you will, of some of the land use bills, I'm going to share this idea that there's a lot of high-value farmland, and I think a lot of people recognize there's a lot of high-value farmland, and some of it even to the point of being profitable. But with Measure 37, if you own some of that high-value farmland, you know the value, the market value is much higher than it was before if you fit, if you qualify. There's a lot of secondary lands. I own both some high-value farmland and some secondary lands. I'm not looking to develop, but I'm just saying that this is a situation that would maybe give some consideration to do like they do in wetland mitigation, where you trade some high-value farmland waivers for some secondary land that doesn't qualify, so that we get people enticed to, and just let the marketplace figure it out. Don't put a lot of strings on it, acre for acre, whatever. So you begin to get people that would think more they'd like to live in the foothills with some elevation, perhaps, rather than in the flatlands and the high-value farmland where you can't see anything but your neighbor. And I think it would accomplish some things that we're all concerned about. If we can keep high-value farmland in farming, that's good. Hopefully it's done through the marketplace and not by mandate. But this is something I'd like to see the committee perhaps or someone take on as an amendment to perhaps one of the land use bills.
Any questions of Mr. Stoneberg? Gentlemen, I appreciate all of you being here, and we will have a further discussion in these areas, and I appreciate your comments, and we look forward to talking to you again. We will close the work session, correction, the public hearing on House Bill 3243 and 3244, and Glenn, I'll have you come right back up as we open a public hearing on House Bill 2652. And your 338-page amendment.
I want you to explain on page.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, House Bill 2652 is one which we've just recently been given a very lengthy amendment, the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments will essentially replace the original bill. The original bill, its intent was to had a number of changes, but to overhaul the state land use planning system. The Dash 1 amendments, as best I can tell, will abolish the state land use planning system. It will abolish the Land Use Board of Appeals. It will abolish the different parts of the LCD. And so the amendment is 317 pages because, in part, where anywhere in the state statutes that the LUBA or DLCD or LCDC appears, that had to be stricken. So that's the reason why this one is so thick. And I think I've given you probably a very fair but short overview of a very lengthy piece of measure and an amendment. And I think Mr. Stoneberg can probably cover in the gaps.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to know whether the administrator has read every single one of the 300 pages.
I did a fair job during lunch break of skimming it, so actually,
unfair question would be fine.
For the committee members, I think it's fair to say that the real heart and soul, I think, of the amendments can be found on page 2 and 3 in the bold language, and then, as I said, the rest of the sections seem to be appearing to the neat references.
Some of us read it over breakfast.
Who might that be?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have written testimony that I passed out to you, and I spent a little bit of time talking about my experience with land use. I won't bore you with details of my life with land use, except to relate that this has been something that I've dealt with on a personal nature, and I served on the Lyle County Planning Commission many years ago, and it was kind of interesting because it was the first land use plan in the state to get a review by the state. They were the first county to get their land use plan completed. And when it came back for review, it was amazing how many changes then that the state required of the county to make. And I suddenly woke up and said, well, this isn't the county land use plan. This is the state's plan. And we were being mandated to deal with that. I remember a case, and if any of you have ever been to Willow County and driven into Enterprise, just before you drop into the town and the city limits, up on the left there's this hillside, and right now it's covered with houses, a hotel, and a Forest Service building. When I was on the Land Use Planning Commission, the farmer who owned that wanted to build houses there because he'd been raising hay. He had to pump the water up from the river. The cost was prohibitive. He was going in the red on raising hay. But it was zoned exclusive farm use, and he was denied. And I could never quite understand that. I moved away from there in 1987, and that's when, I know he sold it to someone else at a very low value. And then I see these houses, and I see the Forest Service building, and I see the hotel. And eventually someone else decided that that was the best use for that land, and it wasn't very profitable to farm. It made me think about, here we were taking away this individual's right to sell their land, and then somebody else capitalizes on it. That's happened throughout the state. I spent nearly 30 years as a member of the Oregon Farm Bureau. During the 15 years or so, I did lots of battles in discussion about land use and property rights, and I think I lost every one of those discussions. And so I've spent a lot of time talking about that. I spent a little time working for Oregonians in Action about 6 months when they had the U.S. Supreme Court case with Dolan versus City of Tigard. And it was interesting to see that the U.S. Supreme Court, in a sense, for the first time in a long time, put property rights right up there with the other rights of the Bill of Rights on an equal footing, if you will. And it had been kind of considered a poor stepchild to the other rights. It was overshadowed by them. And I just wanted to provide you with the experience that I've had with land use issues so that you know that this amendment before you is not a whimsical idea. And I hope it's not taken lightly, but rather it is a real solution to a real problem. Now, if you go north of here a little ways, up by Woodburn, you see some of the best farmland in the Willamette Valley, and in essence, almost some of the best farmland in the nation, and it's getting covered up because of urban growth boundary. And we see that throughout the state, as we know, along the rivers and the railroads that were developed in the bottomlands, cities sprung up, and the cities to continue to grow, and the best lands we have. So what I'm saying is that we have a system that doesn't work anymore. And in my idea, it really didn't work once they got away from the idea that cities and counties were going to do their own land use planning. And once they become all of these extra goals of the state, and the state was going to control this and that, it got away from the local needs and values, and that's what this bill is all about. Now, this bill is 317 pages long. It's gotten stuff for the original bill, but I want to tell you what the words that I wrote for the amendment, and there were 27 words, and it simply said to abolish the Oregon land use laws in entirety and replace them with a simple statement that every city and county shall have a land use plan. Now, this bill, then, this amendment, is what it takes to extract the tentacles of how land use is grown into virtually every fiber of government. It has grown and grown and grown. and to the point that it takes this much to extract it. Now, I don't know what the cost of land use is, because it's more than just to pay for expenses by the commission or the department and so on for personnel. It's much more than that. It gives you an idea when you see this. It looks like there is a page, more than a page and a half, of nothing but listing of ORSs that are being touched. That you have to go to that many different places in Oregon law to find where land use is affecting those laws and the agencies and the budgets and so on and so on. So the concept is real simple. It's not an unfunded mandate, because every city and county already has a land use plan. This just simply says that the local elected officials will decide what that plan is. They will decide what the needs of their county, the needs of the counties are, and the people, and what the best resource land might be, and ways that you can still develop and give people the quality of life, but not being done from state government. I know we could go on and on about how simple this is, but I think this is what we could do to resolve a lot of our issues, including the economy of the state. Because for some reason, and I've seen it happen in Harney County, Wallowa County, Mountain County, when a lot of the rural counties are so desperately in trouble with running county government, their land values are down, their businesses are gone, but they're hamstrung with the land use laws, and it's being done from the state, not from what the county would like to do and what they see as their needs. So I would hope that you would think a little bit like I do, that local people can make better choices about their communities, their needs, their laws that affect them and their people. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Stoneberry? Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, sir. I accept this isn't a whimsical attempt. I wonder whether you would be interested in a companion bill, perhaps a constitutional amendment, that would prevent then special interest groups from coming back to the state legislature to ask for special purpose bills to override county decisions they didn't like.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I would not believe that. I would make that deal with you. Which doesn't hold any water, but I don't believe that's what we need. What I see happening is that the people of the county that elect the officials, if they don't get their way, this is what's made our country work, and you know that, is that you either elect new people that follow your philosophy, you go to meetings, you write articles to the newspaper saying this is what we need. That's a political process that we have. And it's representative and it's still democratic. And I've had people ask, well, what if right on the border, I mean, some people own a little bit of land in this county and this county, and one county's laws would be different than the other county. I said, so be it. It'll take care of itself. If you don't like the land use laws here, you can sell your land and buy land over here. We don't need government dictating all of that.
If I'll just finish the comment. I think this is an interesting idea, and I sit here and talk about local control almost all the time, unless I don't like the particular decision. But we face a Senate bill. We had one 2 days ago in this session that I was in the minority on that simply was a special purpose bill to override the kind of decision we have. I'm being lobbied on some other ones that are special purpose, and in fact, one we're here today is a similar issue. I mean, one of the things that there is a state interest in this, and that's the interest is I want a state rule if I don't like the county decision, or I want a county rule if I don't like the state decision. How do we mitigate that problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, it depends on who the individual is that's doing that. You see, I'm a believer that you have, first of all, you have the least amount of government possible. In this case, you just have one government, whether it's city government or whether it's county government. And that's it. That's the end of the discussion. You don't go to the state if you don't like what the county did. And I've heard people say, well, we maybe need to regionalize land use. And maybe we should have five different districts in the state, or four districts, or east, west, or whatever it might be. And I say, well, I'm in favor of that, but why not have it be 36 regions? We already have the government set up for those 36 regions and called counties. And it's not trying to be tongue-in-cheek about this. It's just this is a reality that will work. And it was working. And when Senate Bill 10, before Senate Bill 100, came along and basically said that every city and county shall have a land use plan, well, no problem. Let's just do it. But it's where it's grown to, and you can see that. This is obvious now, where it has grown to. And are we going to do something about it, or is it going to stay in existence, and we just deal with things like Measure 37, which half the people like it, and to those that can get a claim, and the other people don't like it. But we still really haven't fixed the problem. We're still trying to ignore it like it isn't there.
Any further questions? Len, thank you. We may bring this bill back indeed. So, Peggy Lynch, Ilan Hassan, and Lane Chettle. Is Lane here?
Yep.
Oh,
he's lurking in the back.
He's sitting in the back row. Mr. Director, I'll ask you to go first if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, of the Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development, so far.
Does it make you feel a little odd testifying on this?
Chair, I'm okay. I have a, my name is on monster.com as me. No, I'm kidding. No, in all seriousness, and I'm sorry.
We missed that sense of humor in the legislature.
I go back for several sessions with Mr. Stonebank. He was a constituent of mine, in fact, when I was in the legislature, and think highly of him. We are at odds, as you can imagine, on this bill. I was not aware of the Dash 2 amendments. I knew something was coming. Certainly had not seen them before I got in today. I agree with Mr. Wettke that it doesn't take long to get into the meat and substance of it when you get about halfway down page 2. It's apparent. I guess what I would suggest to you, Mr. Chair, is that this takes us in exactly the wrong direction. I think I agree with Representative Greenlick wholeheartedly that there is a state interest in the land use planning program. State interest that includes not only the livability of our communities, protection of our environment, conservation of our resources, but also our economic development as well, and some assurance by those who want to play in the business of economic development that there is not a patchwork but a consistent application of rules and regulations on which they can depend. Having said that, neither do I want to be characterized as a defender of the status quo. When the governor asked me to come into the directorship at DLCB, one of the charges was to ascertain what changes in the program need to be made. We have been making those changes as we have been able, even in the past year and few months. And as you know, we have introduced Senate Bill 82, which encourages a very thoughtful review of the entire program, including the state and local relationship in the land use planning arena. That bill has passed out of the Senate. The Environment and Land Use Committee is in Ways and Means. It's part of our governor's recommended budget, and would commend that to you as a much more appropriate and I believe productive way to address Mr. Stonebrook's concerns, but also the concerns of those who support the program, those who would rather than abolish it, make changes in the program, but maintain it so that all parties' interests could be represented again, and that what I believe would be a much more thoughtful undertaking than this rather blunt instrument of the Dash 2 amendments. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for the director? Seeing none, thank you, Lane, very much. Ms. Lynch.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Today I am representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and you have before you a short letter regarding House Bill 2652. I have not seen any amendments, so I actually studied the original stuff that you put together. As you know, we are a grassroots nonpartisan political organization. We have chapters statewide We have been involved in support of Oregon's land use, statewide land use planning program since its inception. We understand that you have problems with, and that there are problems around the state with implementing Measure 37, and we certainly appreciate your consideration of solutions, but we have grave concerns regarding the particular House Bill before you, 2652. As a result of this bill and others related to how we might take a second look at our land use program, the League recently created a list of principles which you will see attached. Basically, the first one says we support the program, we oppose dismantling the current program, we support consistency statewide for local implementation of Measure 37. And that's an issue that we, as we are aware of the variety of claims going on around the state and the variety of processes, have become extremely concerned about how fairly and equally each Oregonian is being treated when handling Measure 37 claims. We, of course, support the opportunity for citizen involvement in all phases of the land use planning process. We oppose changes that would limit or inhibit future decision making, and some of that is true in this bill and others. We support personal property rights commensurate with the protection of the public health and environmental protection, but consideration must be given to the rights of all property owners, not just those filing claims. We believe that the choices to whether to pay compensation or to waive should be determined by the local decision-making body. They have the access to the information on a specific case that's extremely important. We believe that there should be a comprehensive review of the current land use planning program, and therein I echo Director Shetterly's comments. The League believes that Senate Bill 82, which provides for a comprehensive review of the program with broad public engagement, would lead to more broadly accepted answers that are better for all of Oregon. And I would like to go back in history very quickly. And in the summer of 2002, the League put together a land use progress and challenges document. As a result of that, we reviewed the history. Over 75 open hearings and workshops were held when we created the first land use program. 10 of the goals were selected by the legislature or proposed by the legislature and were part of that hearings process. 4 of them came out of the hearings process. And I'm going to, the 4, public facilities and services, transportation, energy conservation, and urbanization all came about as a result of a conversation with Oregonians about the kinds of goals they wanted in their statewide program. We can't do that with 10 public hearings around the state and all of this happening in a very short period of time. We have to have a comprehensive, broad engagement of lots of people. Over 10,000 people participated back in 73, 74, 75. That's, I don't know what that would be today, but that's a significant amount of people. And lastly, the current bill requires that citizen counties then have a new comp plan within 1 year. It was 1980 before 206 of the then 277 cities and counties met compliance with the statewide goals. So the other thing we are concerned about is the huge planning burden that you would be placing on local government. Other issues I see in the current bill relate to the power of the counties over the cities and that they seem to have a greater role than maybe cities would be thrilled about. It assumes an agreement amongst all of those parties, and I have to tell you, I've been at this for over those 30 years, and I know that there are many cities and counties who can work together on specific issues but also feel very territorial and very believe that they understand the subset within the state goals. They understand the subset of issues which are pertinent to them. Those are the main issues I wanted to point out, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Again, we support Senate Bill 82, the broader land use discussion.
The committee has been...
has not received Senate Bill 82 yet, so...
No, but those who may be a part of Ways and Means or may be a part of budget discussions certainly need to be aware that that's an important issue because it does cost some money to have that broad public engagement.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Lynch? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lynch, I agree with you on the idea of having hearings. While it's difficult sometimes to get people out, would that not be speaking to House Bill 2652 in that it would allow people in their own county to be speaking out more and taking it out further into the rural areas of the state rather than having it centralized in one body?
Well, both of those things occur today. We now have the statewide framework plan, which sets up the basic goals that we believe as a state that we need to meet. And there's a reason for the statewide interest. It includes the amount of public investment that takes place on land, for instance, in transportation, in a variety of public facilities. So there is a statewide interest in making sure that the land use, there is a statewide land use framework. But currently today, taking that framework, local cities and counties have comprehensive plans and development codes for which they have those conversations in their local communities. I believe it's really important to have both of those elements, and I am certainly have been an advocate. Just recently finished my second term on the State Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee for LCDC, so I certainly believe in citizen involvement.
Any further questions? Representative Sumner.
Thank you for coming, Ms. Lynch. Would you tell us, please, did your organization take any position on Measure 37 last November?
Yes, we were opposed to Measure 37.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Ms. Lynch, if this committee does intend to visit the compensation issue and other issues in regards to Measure 37 before we conclude this session, and should the League of Women Voters take a position or have a concept or an idea on how we might approach that compensation issue, we would be most interested in you coming back to talk to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Hassan, sorry to make you wait, but you're always worth waiting for.
It's always worth the wait. Thank you, Chair Gerard, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan, the lobbyist for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I will oppose House Bill 2652 because we support land use planning. I think over time it's had a benefit for all of Oregon. And while it's been a benefit, I think improvement is always welcome. In the way to look at improvement, as Dr. Shadley said, a thoughtful review of the problems of land use planning and the successes of it, I think, are prudent. And I also think they're consistent with the legacy of this legislative body, which has done some great work over the years, and I hope we continue that. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I did not read the Dash 2 amendments, so somewhat limited in that respect.
I think it's just Dash 1s.
I didn't read those either.
Any questions of Mr. Hassan? Seeing none, thank you, panel, very much. Jim Welsh.
Maybe this is the final person
signed up to testify on this bill. Good afternoon, Jim.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am Jim Welsh, representing Oregon State Grange. And I just want to give you a quick, very quick flavor. I passed this on to your committee administrator, the testimony that we were providing, but I want to give some, just a little commentary on that. Oregon State Grange has a definite attitude about the land use planning system in Oregon. Looking at the Oregon State Grange, we need to see an organization that has, yes, we've diminished in membership over time, but the greatest percentage of that membership is in the rural areas. And that membership has lived and made their living on farmland, and they have done that for over 100 years. So it's kind of nice to get an idea sometimes about their attitude towards something that this body has all the control over in the biggest respect. And the policy that they passed in 2004 stated that the Oregon State Grange urged the complete repeal and or overhaul of Oregon land use planning. That's pretty strong language. And be it further resolved that the order to patrons of husbandry are informed citizens in rural land use planning and should have a special place in the public input process rather than out-of-state funded special interest groups, like when they go on to say a number of groups there. Resolved that the Oregon land use planning has had a negative effect on the sustainability of rural family farms due to restrictive and inflexible state mandate zoning and the Department of Land Conservation and Development administrative rules, which often go beyond the intent of the legislature to negatively affect Oregon. And resolved, grandfather property rights of ranges and of rod and gun clubs have been negated in some cases by Oregon land use planning, and Oregon's legislature was unable also to pass complete laws allowing the reuse of old or existing mill sites. Resolved that the lack of new jobs in Oregon is directly related to the lack of zoned, ready-to-build industrial land. The governor's executive order to streamline land use planning in order to create industrial sites larger than 100 acres has not shown much success. They have realized these things. They put this into language and presented this to the delegates in their 2004 June meeting in Joseph, Oregon. It's interesting how they see land use planning in Oregon. House Bill 2652, being 183 pages long, as I understand, even in 2003, if we were to have the same bill, which we did, I understand, I guess it was something around 150 pages. Now it takes 180 pages to reduce it to nothing. And then a 300-page amendment, as we were just talking about a few minutes ago. This should be the first indication that Oregon's land use system is in trouble. Very possibly verging on uncoordinated, unmanageable, unfair, and ineffective land use system. Multiple legislative sessions since the late 80s addressing needed changes in the system is the second indicator that Oregon's land use system is verging on uncoordinated, unmanageable, unfair, and ineffective planning system. The third and most obvious indicator is the vote of the people of Oregon as they resoundingly passed Measure 37. Just thought it would be important to share something from rural Oregon and how they view land use planning in Oregon. It's not, of course, always supported by 100% of members, but it takes, just like this body, a majority of those delegates within the state range to pass something like that. They're not very happy with it, but they sure would appreciate this body doing something very comprehensively to adjust it, to make it more friendly, more manageable, more coordinated, especially coordinated with the local county government who administers our statutes and OARs. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Any questions of Mr. Welch? Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you being here. That concludes the testimony committee on House Bill 2652. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2652 and open a work session on House Bill 3312. Prior to our convening, I had a conversation with both groups that are represented here today on this issue and asked both groups to select three people who would represent them. This is a work session only, so public testimony is only on the basis of invited. We also have Representative Barnhart, who will doesn't count amongst the three.
I noticed that.
That didn't come out right, Representative. I'm sorry about that.
Representative, why don't you you start off, and that way I know you have a time problem. But Sam, would you read what 3312 is all about?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3312 is one which originally started out allowing for government bodies to contract with other entities for different facets of things that they can't do relative to permits. The amendment essentially replaces the original provisions of that bill and is one which relates now to the designation of historic properties, and the amendments will allow property owners who have a historic designation to be able to essentially opt out of that designation. It could be state, local, and also federal. So, and it would not pertain to any building permits that may be required for that property or any other land use permits that may be required, only the historic designation of the site.
Thank you, Sam. Good afternoon, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm a state representative from Central Wayne and Linn counties. My interest in this bill really comes up as a result of issues that arose in the city of Eugene in the last several years, and the attempts and resistance to attempts to immediately designate an area which is not in my district but which is near my district and which I know very well as a historical area. And I have to tell you, I may not use the words precisely because there are several different designations here. And I'm having prepared, and will have down for you shortly, a copy of a part of the Eugene Modernism Strategies piece, which describes the approach of the city of Eugene toward this issue. The essence of which, I think, is to research neighborhoods to determine what areas ought to be considered designated as historic, and thereby place restrictions on them. Now, what concerns me about that Eugene plan is a description in the strategies which indicates that there are certain approaches which the city does not want to pursue because they're problematic because of Oregon's owner consent laws, which allows a property to opt out of regulation. For this reason, the city I'm quoting here has chosen to endorse historic districts through listing in the National Register. When evaluating the creation of a historic district, it's advisable to implement an educational campaign and so forth, and they go on to talk about their approach. And then further on in their description, they talk about recommended strategies and give a high priority to the strategy of designating city landmarks, designations of historic resources as city landmarks or in the National Register of Historic Places. The sense that I get from reviewing this document, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is that it's an attempt on the part of the city to designate areas as historic and to do it at the potential expense of individual landowners who can opt out of one form of designation under the current law, but not out of the other form of designation. And I think this bill, especially the dash two amendments to this bill, deal with that issue by preventing the city from effectuating a historical regulation of these properties against the landowner's consent. And I support them for that reason.
Any questions of Representative Barnhart? Seeing none, thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The six people committee that we will be hearing from, three in favor of House Bill 3312 and three opposed, we will bring those who are in favor of the bill forward first. They are Al Johnson, Carol Lee Berger, and Ginevra Ralph.
Thank you. Chairman Gard and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm Ginevra Ralph, and I represent more than 315 property owners who have filed formal notarized letters of objection with the Federal Park Service to this proposed South University Historic District. We believe in historic preservation that is managed through a program of incentives and not by coercive imposition of regulations on property owners. As Representative Barnhart mentioned, currently under Oregon law, if a city or the state designates a piece of property owned by a citizen as historic, that owner can opt out both of the designation and the additional regulations concerning on how you can remodel that property that are imposed by the cities on historic properties. However, you cannot opt out of the regulations if your property is designated on the Federal Register as part of an historic district. Statewide, preservation professionals and some enthusiasts have used this route as a strategy to control what people do with their properties by promoting multiple federal historic districts in places like Albany, Corvallis, Portland, Bend, Springfield, Ashland, and other communities. There are 13 in planning stages in Eugene alone, but I would underscore that this is not in any way a local issue. This is a statewide problem. Federal designation is indeed honorary. However, Oregon cities impose regulations and design guidelines on all of the properties contained in the district, regardless of the age of that property or its historic quality. Consequently, we have 1997 houses that need to be remodeled in accordance with design guidelines, or a historic garage that is falling down that is not an important building at all. And they don't let you know what those guidelines will be until after the designation at the federal level has been made. The Dash 2 Amendment protects personal property rights by allowing individual property owners to opt out of the special historic preservation regulations imposed by local governments on historic districts if they have objected during the formation of such a district. It does not preclude a district from being formed, and I really hate to correct the committee's administrator. It does not allow, and this is really important, it does not allow you to opt out of the federal designation. It's just the regulations that become imposed as a result of that designation. It also does not preclude owners who opted out initially from later opting in response to creative incentive programs. I think I'm done. Thank you very much.
We want the entire panel speak, and then we'll ask questions of the entire panel. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Chairman Gerard and other representatives, for allowing me to speak. My name is Carol Berger, and I'm a property owner. I'm also a preservationist, and I enjoy very much purchasing and restoring historic building. And we did such in the city of Springfield as an adult foster care facility, and we did another building that we purchased in the city of Eugene for our primary residence. In the year 2002, when we purchased our building in Springfield, at that time, we knew that it was in a historic district, and we knew that there were regulations. At that time, there were 44 pages of regulations. A year later, the regulations went up 7,100% increase in the regulations that we now have in that district. Last year, I very carefully attempted to make sure that when we wanted to put an addition onto our home, the adult foster care facility, that I would find out what the committee, the Historic Commission, would or would not allow us to do in preparation to save us money and not to have too many changes by the architect. And I was told that they would not accept the addition as a single family addition, but instead I'd have to have it designated as a duplex. At that point, we had already spent $25,000 to have the architect and the blueprints and the permit fees for initial permits, and made presentations to the Historic Committee. Now, because of the designation being duplex rather than a single family home, because of the regulation guidelines of that particular district, we cannot get a mortgage for the home. Because when the appraisal comes in, it comes in $100,000 short of the value of the building. And we've been turned down by dozens of banks. So the building was completed in January, and we still are without a mortgage. In the city of Eugene, where we have our regular home, it was not in a historic district when we purchased it. However, now there have been, from what I understand from the meetings I've attended, several neighbors who were upset that students from the University of Oregon park and or rent within that area, so they want to put a stop to it. And by going through the back door of preservation, they have now submitted my entire neighborhood as just that. I really, as a property owner, cannot afford to lose as much money as we currently may lose because of additional regulations on a property which we do not want to become a part of a neighborhood that was not historic when we bought there. But because we know what could happen because of our business property, we really cannot afford as property owners to find out what those regulations will be after we make that financial investment. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to allow you to hear that story. Any questions?
We'll wait until the entire town stops. Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you can see, I'm sitting here between two very articulate proven preservationists. Each one has made a contribution in that area. There are folks who want to be able to do it, however, somewhat more on their own terms. And that's really consistent with the intent of the federal legislation that we're talking about here. And Representative Barnhart made the point that strategy that's been adopted is to key local permitting requirements for historic properties, because those are the one kinds of designations that you can't opt out on. The very ironic, I guess, aspect of this is that the reason that those federal requirements are made not optional, very clearly from legislative history, is that they were not going to have a regulatory consequence. It was the intent of Congress that this be an incentive program. I just have to read you something from the House report on the adoption of this provision, which says that we concur that the provision for owner consent should be incorporated into any situation where an owner's private property rights are in any way infringed upon or abridged. However, the listing of a property on the National Register does not take away or infringe upon the private property rights of the owner, and it is for that principal reason that we see no logic in requiring the owners must first consent before an item can be listed on the register. That is the premise of the federal statute that says there is no consent. How ironic that the fact that that non-consent provision is in the federal statute now becomes the hook upon which local governments can escape the opt-out provisions that the Oregon legislature has adopted for state and local legislation. The legislation that is proposed changes only one aspect and addresses that issue. In so doing, it really brings Oregon law into complete harmony with the purpose of that statute. And I just want to run through once again what the Dash 2 Amendment does and what it does not do. The proposed amendment allows individual property owners to opt out of local regulations if they objected during the formation of a National Historic District. It does not preclude a National Historic District from being formed, listed, or registered. It does not allow property owners to opt out of federal historic district designations or eligibility determinations. That's a point that Ginevra emphasized, and I want to be sure everybody's clear on that. I believe Carol did as well. It does not allow property owners to opt out of federal historic designations or eligibility determinations. It also does not allow someone who did not object during formation to opt out. So existing districts aren't affected by this legislation.
It does not preclude local government from regulating properties in federally listed districts whose owners did not object and opt out. So those regulations are not set aside. They apply everywhere else in the district. It does not change the current right of property owners to opt out of state and local designations and regulations. It leaves that intact. Property owners can already opt out of federal listings. And the important thing about this is that individual property owners can already opt out of individual federal listings, which removes their properties from these local application requirements. It really is only those in the districts who have a who can actually be forced into a district by a majority of their neighbors who don't have the opt-out right. The problem is that the local definition of historic properties in Eugene Code and most other codes that do this kind of thing includes all properties in federally listed districts. And that includes non-contributing properties. So if you have a property that really is just there because it's surrounded by other properties that maybe meet the definition in some way, then you have to become historically more correct even if you weren't to start with. So it's a way of kind of homogenizing a neighborhood that may be diverse to start with. The these distinctions and are described, I think, quite well in the chart which you've been provided with. It has six cells. On one of those cells, it has any changes that are indicated in it. Again, those are very, very minor changes that simply bring into line the intent of the federal legislation, the intent of 1995 legislation, and do it in a way that we strongly believe will result in districts that have more integrity, because there will be less incentive to size them to get certain vote results, as is indicated by the changes in size of this district. There will be less opposition to districts which are well qualified, and there will be certainly more harmony in neighborhoods. The problem we have right now is that the way this is set up is it's essentially a delegation to a group of private people of the authority to impose a set of homeowners association type compatibility regulations enforced by the local government through a process which has standards that are not designed for imposing regulations. The federal standards are standards that were set up to qualify a district for consents and other kinds of things. They are very, very loose definitions. It is not hard to become a national registered district. It's becoming less hard as time goes on and more recent districts become eligible under the 50-year tail, and as we actually become more tolerant of and aware of the need for diversity in our neighborhoods, which is a good thing. The problem that you end up with, though, is that you end up with a program and a set of criteria designed to establish an incentive district being used to create a regulatory district, and having it done around the back way so that in the end it doesn't have to go through any of the hearings processes that are used to establish normal hearings, historic districts or any other district in a local jurisdiction. Does not change the fact that everybody remains completely subject to all building permit requirements that everybody else is currently subject to. They remain subject to all zoning requirements, planning requirements, fire code requirements that everyone else is subject to. It is only the special permitting requirements and the application requirements, the extensive notice requirements, the rights of appeal of neighbors who don't like the color of your paint or the size of your fence or the shape of your dormers that is added on to this. It is something which is at the level of an irritation rather than something that probably is going to be the kind of thing that really makes it worthwhile for a property owner to go through the extensive appeal process. It's an appeal process that isn't going to likely get you anywhere, because the appeal from the initial decision is it's an appeal to the local historic review board, which is a specialized board with a mission for historic preservation. It has, as it should, a certain institutional bias. It would not be the planning commission or any independent hearings official. No homeowner looking at that, the prospects of that and the costs involved with that and going on to LUBA would be very likely to take it on. It would only be someone who is a commercial developer. So in the end, it becomes something where people just end up having to live with something has been imposed on them by their neighbors. Long term, that kind of thing stirs up or nurtures a certain amount of irritation with them that simply isn't healthy for either historic preservation or the neighborhoods in which it's being attempted. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of any of our panel? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just of the panel, because I want to get back to the ground, to the South Eugene, South University area, and ask just a few questions so we can get up to date. What is the status of the project now? I hear different things. I'm trying to interpret where we are in the process.
Why don't I try, and then you correct me if I'm wrong. As I understand it, Representative Ackerman, what has happened is that the document, the application was originally returned by the federal keeper because of counting problems. They really got to the merits. And then was sent back by the state historic preservation officer to the city or to the local community to address those problems. There was a long period during which we attempted to have the city take a look at it in terms of its land use impacts and through the normal land use process. In the end, a mediator took a look at the issue, and in the end, Mayor Tory decided that it should not proceed with the city's endorsement anyway at the end of his term. Shortly after that, there was a meeting with the new mayor. People came away from that meeting with very different impressions of what the outcome was. And then shortly after that, about a month after that, we got a letter from the Mayor Piercy saying that this is no longer really a city project. This is going to be something that's up to the local neighborhood, but I will endorse it. I then made inquiries at the State Historic Preservation Office and found that private citizens had resubmitted the document. This was early in April, I believe, or late March, and was told, and I've been told more recently, that what's happening is that the state office is now looking through those materials to make sure that they are in order, and that once it has got the information in its databases and done the analysis of the vote count and whatnot, its intention is to resubmit it to the federal keeper without another substantive review at the state level. What would happen then is at the point at which it's resubmitted to the state keeper, at that time and slightly before, there would be an additional notice given to everybody, and there's a 45-day comment period during which objections continue to be received. At the end of that 45-day period, the keeper either makes a determination that it's listed or not. So that's where we are now.
Okay, that told me, I think, more about the process than I needed to know. But I'm trying to figure out the stance we've had. Have property owners had any chance legally before today to opt out at any time?
No, the way it works right now is that you can opt out of local designation.
Right.
We can't opt out because the statute doesn't provide that opportunity right now. Everybody who has objected here has essentially said they would want to opt out, but there's no district to opt out of yet. There won't be a district to opt out of until it's listed.
All right. If someone can now, if we pass this this bill, and folks can opt out of both the state and the federal requirements, as I understand it, what are the consequences either to the remaining district or to the people that opt out?
The people that opt out, they become, they remain subject to all the usual building permit and zoning requirements that would apply if they were not in an historic district. The people who are in the district, they remain subject to all of the usual zoning requirements plus the special permitting requirements that are applicable to what are defined in the Eugene Code as historic properties, which includes properties within an historic district. Those include...
Okay, if the bill is passed and more than 51% opt out of both the state and the federal component of the amendments,
yeah.
what happens to the district.
Under, yeah, that's not opting out. That's, there's a different term for that, which is objecting. Under federal rules, if more than 51% object, then the district is not formed. That's what happened back in 1981 with the smaller district.
Can that happen without those dash two amendments?
That could happen if we can come up with 51% of this much larger district.
And last question. I usually understand that there were tax benefits for being in the historic district. There's a property tax freeze for so many years. Is that still in effect? And do those opt out, retain that benefit, or are they able to claim that benefit?
No, maybe Ginevra can talk about that.
And then maybe Carol may know more actually about some of that. There are two kinds of tax incentives at the moment. One's a tax freeze, property tax freeze, if your property qualifies, and you have to apply for that. There's another one that's available as a tax credit only for commercial properties. Again, you have to apply for that. And those tax freezes vary of a 15-year tax freeze on residents and with a possible extension, but there's another bill pending for another 15 years. But again, not every property will qualify, and not every property that does qualify will an owner want to go through the extensive paperwork to apply for that. And then that's where the other thing that people have heard is that you have to open your house once a year to the public if you get one of those benefits.
Last question, is it possible then to own property within the district and opt out and not have any tax benefit but still be subject to the historic regulations?
At the moment, for any historic district that's designated in the state, you are under the regulations that are locally imposed by the cities.
So it's likely you can still have the benefit of, well, it's still possible not to have the tax benefit but still be subject to the regulations.
Absolutely. Most properties in, for instance, let's use our historic district, most properties will not receive any tax benefit because the owners won't apply for them and or they don't qualify.
Okay. If they don't qualify, they're still subject to the
sexual
controls.
Yes. Even if your house was built last year, you would be required to go through the Type 2 land use process application. And what's even fuzzier is that you will be required to remodel your house in a way that is within keeping with this historic district. We recently asked the mayor, what does that mean for properties? And we've been told it's premature to give you that answer because it is not yet an historic district. So it's really hard to know what kind of an impact that's going to have on your personal house, other than we know it will have an impact.
Thank you. Any other questions of this panel?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
Thanks. I don't know which of you is most qualified to answer this, so you can choose. Do you intend for the dash to make a retroactive change for districts that have already gone through the process of formation?
No,
it's not retroactive. In fact, depending on the speed of everything, our district may not benefit from the passage of this amendment. So it would not be retroactive to any district until it takes effect.
This is only if you object it during the formation of a district. You then have the option of opting out during the proposed nomination of your neighborhood or the area. Anything in existence you don't opt out of.
If I might follow up on that.
Follow.
So as I read the amendment, and as you've explained it, if I object during the formation and I end up on the losing side of that, in other words, a majority disagrees with me and forms the district, even though I had objected, then I can withdraw from the district.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, no, you can't withdraw from the district.
you can opt out of having the regulations imposed when you choose to remodel your house. You, in fact, are part of the district, very much so. Your property counts either as a historic contributing, historic non-contributing, or non-contributing house, non-historic non-contributing house. And you're only opting out of needing to go to the city planning department to submit plans to the historic preservation person before you can submit your plans and get sign-off from him or her before you then go to the building department for your regular permitting process. You have to notify, you have to put a notification out that you are going to be doing certain changes to your property. You notify your neighbors. There's a public notification process. Again, regardless of the village, or if you're, no, anyway.
There's an extra.
Yeah, let's follow up again. This sounds to me then like we hold a process by which the majority chooses to take a certain action, and I end up in the minority, but after the majority makes that decision, I get to do what I want to do anyway. How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, that's called democracy, and that makes a lot of sense when you've joined a homeowners association or when you're part of a city or a voting body. What this process does is set up an arbitrary district which is designed by the proponents and which the vote is a non-governmental vote and it's basically a poll of a neighborhood in which the neighborhood gets to act as if it's already a homeowners association. You know, if we want that, we can move into a PUD, but that's the deal.
Well, I think actually you have a process in place. You participated in the process. You were on the failing side, and now you want out of what the majority wants to do. And I, whether I agree with the majority or not, I don't think that's the question before us. The question before us is, if there's a process in place set by law or local ordinance, and people followed it, and you end up on the losing side of it, this essentially gives you an opportunity to say, oh, I don't like the result, so I'm not going to play by that outcome.
Representative Nolan, the process was specifically designed by Congress, not by the local government, not by the state legislature. It was designed by Congress. The Congress had on the table at the time it considered this an option which had required majority consent as opposed to majority objections. It chose to go with majority objections because of the consequences of the process it was setting up. This is a process which has been set up by a different government for a different purpose, which has been hijacked by a state and local government for a third purpose. This is not a legitimate process.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, let me give you a slightly different take on that, too. When this nomination was first proposed, we objected to it on three grounds. One was the process that happened to us, as well as the merit, and we put a campaign out to get notarized letters of objection. Of the 580 or so identified owners at the time, we had over 315, which was more than 51% in opposition. The proponents don't have to do anything other than submit this nomination. They do not even have to write letters of support. The people that we contacted who did not want to write letters of objection were of two sorts. They were either supporters, or they didn't give a darn, or they were in a coma. Those people count as being in support because they did not file a notarized letter of objection. Now, remember also that there are a lot of people who are homebound who can't get out to get a notary to sign that, to endorse their letter. And on top of that, we've got anthrax stuff still happening in D.C. So to send all those letters, some of them got lost in the mail and tossed out. So there's an onus on the objectors to do way more than what a supporter has to do. So it is not about a vote. It is about, the reason this 51% thing came up is that if you own a building, and somebody says that building is historic, and the feds agree and say, yeah, your building, Representative Nolan, is an historic building. Do you want it listed on the Federal Register? You have the opportunity at that point to say, no, I don't. If there are three of you who own it together, 51% of the owners have to agree to not have it listed. They took that way of thinking about a single building where an individual property owner does have the right to opt out of the designation, in fact, and laid it on a district. Now you've got anywhere from 200 to 600 property owners that changes regularly that you have to go make them understand. I mean, everybody's been saying this is complicated. You have to make them understand what these consequences are, that there will be regulations imposed, one-on-one-on-one, and then get them to take that extra step to object. Now, if they don't care, it's not about a positive vote. It's that they haven't objected. So I appreciate what you're saying about being on a losing side, but it ain't a fair table. If they had to do notarized letters of support, you would have a really good point, but they don't.
But, Mr. Chair, I think what we're hearing here is that there is an argument with the way a particular local government has implemented its local ordinances, and I'm very leery of having us try to step in and set a statewide fix that has ripple effects in all kinds of communities in order to settle a disagreement with a local governing board of elected officials. That's what it sounds like is happening.
Well, it's each
Representative Nolan. It was that attitude that got Measure 37 passed in this state. The same feeling.
Any other questions?
Glenn was just here testifying that we shouldn't interfere.
Okay, thank you very much. By the way, I'd like to thank all of the folks who are here and aren't participating in the actual discussion, but the committee feels your presence here and appreciates you being part of the process. It was just a time problem that we have a lot of things to do, and that, as you can already see, we've gone 25 minutes for three people. So that's an extraordinary a lot amount of time, and we're only halfway through. So
thank you.
Thank you again very much. Bob Peters, Marilyn Milne, and Karen Bean. And committee, these will be the final three people to testify, and these folks have all indicated their opposition to this bill. Good afternoon, folks, and welcome.
Do you prefer which one of us should begin?
Pardon?
Does it matter to you which one of us should begin?
It does not.
Chair Garrard and committee members, thank you very much for allowing us to come forward and express our concerns on this. For the record, my name is Karen Bean. I'm here providing testimony on behalf of the City of Portland. I'm currently a senior management analyst with the Office of Management and Budget. I've been involved professionally in historic preservation at the local, state, and federal levels and with the private development community in several jurisdictions for almost 25 years. In my capacity for the city, I had lead responsibility for development and passage of the package of both incentives and local review controls over actions impacting historic properties, an effort that was over 2 years in the making. This effort required substantial involvement and input from the private development community, historic property owners, preservation professionals and activists, and permitting and other agencies. The package was unanimously passed by Portland City Council last October. The City of Portland opposes HB 3312-2, and for the record, the League of Oregon Cities also opposes this measure, as we believe it would undermine local jurisdictions' authority to protect National Register properties. We are concerned that the language of the proposed legislation is ambiguous and poorly crafted as follows. And I do want to say in response to some of the other speakers that we agree that this appears to be a local dispute in one community, and they're proposing solutions that would have far-reaching statewide impacts. I cannot say that every local jurisdiction in the state of Oregon has exactly the same kind of local regulation that the City of Portland does. So to make the presumption that Eugene is the same as Portland, I beg to differ.
We also respectfully disagree with Mr. Johnson's assertion that the on permitting standards and what they apply to and what they don't apply to. We believe that the implications of the language permitting standards applied solely to historic properties is unclear language. Life safety requirements in our jurisdiction are applicable to a broader range of older properties. We are concerned, given the unclear definition of historic properties, that the proposed amendment would inhibit application of life safety permitting standards, such as seismic, fire, and electrical standards, to many buildings in addition to that group of buildings that is, quote, designated historic. And some of the issues that have been raised by our building department of examples of life safety issues that may not be required under this bill include structural upgrades to unreinforced masonry buildings that ensure that people in older brick buildings can escape without loss of life in the event of an earthquake, necessary improvements to faulty electrical systems to avoid electrical fires that often occur in older buildings, etc. I mean, these are just some examples. We're concerned about the language historic property. We think it's unclear. There are multiple definitions in statute and administrative rules under Oregon laws for historic property. For example, under Statewide Planning Goal 5, local governments are required to protect historic resources of statewide significance, which are defined as National Register properties. The proposed amendment appears to be in conflict with this requirement. And the owner consent statute is specifically aimed at local designation and succinctly and purposefully exempts National Register properties. We believe there's confusion with the statutory language on refusal to consent, which is applicable only to local designation processes. Under current Oregon statute, an owner can object any time during a local designation process. This is prior to when the designation takes place. Following designation, an owner's obligation is to show that a local government imposed such designation over the objection of the owner in order to remove designation. There is an implication that local government in this new language, upon receipt of a refusal to consent after a local designation, would be required to remove the designation and exempt the property from permitting standards, when in fact the owner still has the burden post-designation to make a factual showing of the imposition of that designation. In addition, last but not least, and again we have another respectful disagreement with some comments that have been made before, this proposal raises a fundamental policy question as to how historic properties should be protected and the appropriate role of local and state government. This proposal would allow certain owners of National Register properties to take advantage of substantial financial incentives, and contrary to what's been said, they would be able to take advantage of special tax assessment. Whether they opt out of permitting or not, in other words, Oregon special assessment, and yet local jurisdictions have no ability to review owners' actions impacting these properties. We believe that public tax investment deserves public protection of the public's investment and interest in these properties. Thank you again for the opportunity to appear here today, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
We'll take all three first.
Thank you for letting us testify, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Meryl Lynn Milne, and I already, I hope you have a copy of my testimony before you, so I'm not going to read through it. I'll just summarize it. There were four main points I wanted to be sure you were aware of from the perspective of someone who lives in the proposed district and is very interested in having it come to fruition. First of all, House Bill 3312-2, I believe, is the wrong approach to good lawmaking. It takes what should be a majority rules kind of process and gives people the opportunity to ignore that. Secondly, the purpose of the historic district is to recognize, as has been over the course of historic properties, that there is value in having such districts. And so if there's an opt-out, then you, in effect, negate the value of historic properties being recognized. Third, I really believe this is an issue at the city level. not something that you should have to deal with at the state level. But given the reality that I'm sitting here testifying to you about it, you should know that the South University Historic District, as proposed, has the solid and continuing support of at least two-thirds of the proposed residents. That has been measured in different ways, numerous ways, but I've heard some numbers testified to earlier, and I've got to straighten out, if I can here, there was kind of an apples and orange count going on there. There were 185 notarized objections filed. That was out of 460 possible out of the entire district. So about a third did object. I've heard the number 300 some. Well, that was a count. We don't have 460 property owners in the area. So when you hear the number 300, that's out of a different kind of counting system that would total 765. So again, you have a solid majority who have supported this proposed district from the very beginning, and through 7 years of delays have continued to support it. And in fact, proponents offered to be surveyed to give a very accurate count, and opponents declined that opportunity.
My fourth
point here is that historic districts provide an additional level of protection in the land use planning system. I find it very helpful to think that despite goals like infill, which would be very appropriate in our area because we are near downtown Eugene, and despite goals like locating people near where their workplace is, which would be, again, applicable to us because we moved to the University of Oregon, a major employer. But because we could be a historic district, there would be an overarching consideration, and being a historic district means that we would not be required to do the kinds of infill and the kinds of placement of students right next to the university beyond what we already have. Our proposed district is a wonderful mix of different income levels, different housing styles, different periods of early 20th century housing stock, and in fact we are slightly more than 50% renter occupied. It's a terrific blend of people, and I would like to see that maintained through a historic district. A couple of other points. There are, I know, a lot of difficulties with the Federal Register process, that people who feel they do not like that process really need to work at the federal level to try to get it changed so that it will be something they do like to work with. This is not something the city mandated. Residents in the neighborhood twice now have been trying to get a district formed. It is resident propelled by us, not by the city or the feds. There is an existing historic district in Eugene called the East Skinner Butte District. We have talked to people there. Well, what's your experience when you go to the city and you want to do a remodel? And the experience has been very cooperative. There have not been permits required when the homeowner thought, well, gee, maybe there will be. There is a barn from the 1800s that sits right on the property line, doesn't meet current zoning setbacks. No problem. We understand that's an old property. You don't have to do anything to correct that when you work on that barn. So we're very encouraged about the kinds of things that can happen to help us maintain what we love, which is our neighborhood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bob Peters, and I'm from Eugene, and I'm currently the chairman of the South University Neighborhood Association. And this, throughout the years, this is the originating agency, and contrary to her testimony, the documents that were brought up to the SHPO office, I brought them as the chair, and I was directed to do so by the city because we were had been the originator of the nomination. And that leads me into this observation. This has been a very rigorous, a very careful process. There's been nothing slapstick or casual or light about it. There have been 7 years of research and analysis. Hundreds of our citizens have been involved in this process. Every single property was surveyed and found to have a quality that made our neighborhood, which at one time was an addition, the Gross Platt addition to Eugene, a very good example of the way an addition is added to a city and grows over a period of time. Mayor Kelly, among others, made a very strong statement initially that Eugene is so proud of its history. Along the banks of the Willamette and McKenzie, it's rich in history, and it wants to maintain and cherish it. And for that reason, the city has set up a very clear code for management of an historic district. The code is set out in Area 9 of our city code. It's very specific. And you've heard today certain examples of a few tactics. Paint. If you choose a color of paint, you might somehow be disqualified. Not true. The code says nothing whatsoever about paint. The addition to the property in the historic district in Springfield, well, I didn't tell you, was an 1,800-foot addition being proposed. That's bigger than my whole house. And if you attempt to put an addition like that onto a house, it does change the character of the house and does warrant some kind of review. And we want to make it clear that the whole idea that the city has engaged in is to engage in historic preservation, that is, to maintain the quality of what we have. That doesn't mean that there can't be changes. There are, and these are allowed, and there's a process. There's never been an appeal on a decision of the city in our city on a historic district matter. What's happening here is that this nomination process has gone through a federal level of review, which is very rigorous. It's gone through a state level of review, the local level of review. The federal government then asks us to revisit the counting and determination of property qualifications, who had a right to vote. That was done. It was determined that approximately a third of the persons were in opposition. This has gone now to the State Historic Preservation Office. It's poised to go forward to be put on the Federal Register. And hence we have this last-ditch effort to go around the barn and to try to get you folks to do what they couldn't do through the standard process. That is, to elicit enough support to defeat this concept, because a strong majority has favored it all along, and because it's ready now to be implemented, this kind of a fearsome approach that property rights are being trampled on. We submit to you that, in fact, the property rights of all of us are at stake. We want property in our area to be maintained and preserved, and the quality of this neighborhood to be enhanced. As a matter of fact, the chair did refer to Measure 37. I'm glad you did, because in a way it's a safety valve here. If someone feels that their rights are being trampled on in some way because of an historic district being imposed at this date, there is an appeal for compensation, you see, if there has been a loss sustained due to that. The history is, however, that property values are enhanced in a historic district, and we think it's very, very unlikely that any kind of appeal like that would be successful, because people will benefit in terms of their property values. Hence, we are at that point where South Eugene Historic District is about to be implemented. Mr. Johnson recognized that in his initial document to you, that that's about to happen. This is an effort to stop it. It's not an appropriate way for the legislature to intervene in this process and impose then limitations on the whole rest of the state. You asked about retroactivity. I look at this amendment and I see nothing whatsoever about retroactivity. This would apply to every single historic district. There's nothing whatsoever that says only in historic districts enacted after this legislation comes into effect would persons then have the right to opt out of regulation. That's not there. I urge you to look at the amendment. You'll just see that that's not accurate. This would affect all 110 historic districts in the state of Oregon. It would take totally the teeth out of any kind of regulation, and it would be detrimental to all of us. And we ask you to reject this amendment. Thank you so much. And we would answer questions, of course.
Questions from the committee of this panel? Representative Ackerman?
Just a couple.
To refresh my memory, how long has this process been going? I know you mentioned it, and I think I may have caught it.
A little over 7 years, Mr. Ackerman.
So it spanned at least two other legislative sessions?
Yeah.
Probably. Okay. And again, I want someone to review to me what the downside is for a person that opts out at the earliest possible process, but yet the designation that goes forward. It was my understanding that they would not be eligible for any tax benefit. This is somebody that opts out. But they would still be subjected to some architectural controls consistent with the historic district. Would that be correct?
Not correct.
Okay.
The opting out in your amendment is out of regulation.
Okay.
The person would still be in the context of the district, but they just couldn't be regulated. It would be like a person being able to opt out of, a residential zone and say, well, gosh, I want to build a tower here or something, and I'll do it no matter what the regulation is of the zone. That's exactly what the analogy is.
So if I opt out, I'm still within the zone. The zone's approved and up and rolling, and I want to do some modifications. I'm not subjected to the architectural controls of the historic district. I'm just saying that about the third.
That would be correct. That would be correct. If you opt, if this amendment were enacted in a historic district, the regulations in Eugene and our code in Section 9 simply wouldn't apply. And in fact, there would be no regulation whatsoever. You could do whatever you want.
My question is, assuming there's no change in the law and you opt out.
If there is no change in the law, a person does not have the right to opt out of an historic designation on the federal register.
So they still would be subject to the architectural controls of the historic district.
That's correct.
Okay, that's what I needed to know. Thank you.
And Representative, if I may, you mentioned architectural controls, and it's really not... Is it okay for me to speak?
No, I just said that term, but I'm probably not precise, but
it just doesn't reach the level of control. There are guidelines, there are suggestions, there's educational material available so they can show you, hey, here's what houses look like in 1924,
mm-hmm.
and these are the kinds of colors, and these are the kinds of roof lines, but you're not going to jail if you don't follow that.
No, I didn't suggest that. And when I used architectural controls, I didn't know how else to describe the controls that were still being to be applied against the people that were still there and adopted out. Okay. I got that. Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bean, I wanted to clarify your comments earlier about the tax assessment for these properties. There seems to be some different interpretation, and maybe it differs from city to city. I don't know that. But did I understand you correctly that properties within such historic districts can have a beneficial tax assessment or a deferral even if they are not qualified properties, even, for example, if under this bill they would opt out?
My understanding, and I want to be very clear for the chair and the committee, that we were very careful in examining this, and we both conferred with our city attorney and with the SHPO office. And I asked that specific question because I thought it was an important question to have the answer to, and the answer I received was, as I stated, that if people were to opt out, they would still be able to access that special tax assessment program. They'd have to go through the SHPO to do so, but they still could do that. And James, I think, is here.
Any further questions?
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, let me follow up on that. They could go through it, but that would be on a single basis, not on a district basis.
Well, I believe the way the process works with a district is contributing properties within that district, and again, the Deputy Shippo's here, and he's much more expert on this, on the specifics of Oregon law, but I believe if you are contributing property, you can obtain that special tax assessment. You go through the Shippo process to get that assessment, but you can do that.
Contribution only?
Pardon?
On contribution only?
On contributing properties within the district. So in other words, if you are a, let's take an 1880s orientation to a historic district, and you have a 1960s suburban house, you would not be likely to be identified as a contributing property. So you would not be able to receive the special tax assessment. But if you were a contributing property, in other words, a residence dating from that historic period that helped you qualify to become the National Register district that you are, you would be probably considered a contributing property, and you could go for those special tax assessments.
I'm not sure I followed it yet. I have a 1890s home. It's in the district, but I'm not. I've opted out. I still can apply for...
If you are contributing property, I believe so.
You can't live in it, own it?
No. I mean, contributing to the district.
Gotcha. Okay.
If you meet the
time
period of the district.
Any further questions?
Could I add just this one thing?
Sure.
There is no incentive for this program that we're talking about. The historic district for South Eugene is not funded in any way, either by the city or the state or the feds. That's never been part of the intention. The whole idea is to preserve the quality, and the state of Oregon has determined that that should be through local regulation. And that's what we're talking about, is our own city helping us preserve these values. Thank you.
Let's say you had just one block, a one-block area that was a district. What would be the difference between everyone in the block being an independent, having an independent preservation versus a district preservation?
I'd be happy to address that based on what I understand. Districts are recognized, tout ensemble, if you will, which is a French term meaning as a whole. Districts are representing either a neighborhood or a historic function of a city, as opposed to an individual property which has individual historic or architectural associations. Does that help?
Yes, okay. I think. Any further questions? Representative Summer.
Sir, if you could just straighten me out a little bit here. Section 1, subsection 2, it says no permit for demolition of property removed from consideration for historic property shall be issued during a 120-day period. What's that 120 days about?
That's the language in the old bill. That's not part of the amendment that's before you.
Dash 2?
Existing law.
You were seeing that under that existing law crossed my mind. That 120 days of time would allow a city or an organization or a group of homes to possibly buy that home on their own to preserve it. Is that what it was intended for?
I was not here in 1995, that is, I wasn't part of the legislative process, but I'm quite certain that that is the idea, that there is, homes can be removed from a historic district. I mean, it can be blocked up and wheeled away, but there is a time requirement to allow exactly what you suggest.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, panel.
Very much.
The chair would look for a motion on the dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I will move that the -2 Amendment Street, moved into House Bill 3312.
Representative Anderson has moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 3312. Is there a discussion? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is a difficult vote, but I just wanted to explain that I have voted no. I think that this has continued over a long, long period of time. I think there's been an earlier opportunity to seek a legislative solution. I'm reluctant to interject the legislature into a local matter, as I was yesterday or 2 days ago when I voted on against a request that should actually have been submitted to the planning committee, to the Board of County Commissioners. I think that some of the inconvenience to those who choose to opt out, I balance that against the ability of our local neighborhoods to preserve their historic properties, and I will vote against the vote in favor of the latter reason. So that explains my vote both on the amendment and on the bill itself.
Thank you, Representative.
I also think that we're using a local dispute to untie historic preservation throughout the entire state, and I just don't think that case has been made strongly enough to me. Thank you.
Any other comments? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I heard from two different cities today, Springfield and Eugene. Is that correct? So there's at least two. It's more than one. I'm going to be voting for this because I'm really bothered by the size of this district. I'm very much in favor of Historic District 1 that we have in downtown Grants Pass, and I support that very much. But when an area grows from 8 blocks to 20, 30, 40, with the kind of homes that we've seen here, I'm not sure that that's really a historic preservation. I think it's kind of a land use preservation in my feeling. And I think it goes way beyond the idea of preserving several uniquely different types of homes or one specific set of homes. If they were all Frank Lloyd Wrights in one area, if they're all Victorians. But this just, I'm confused as to why the normal progress of development in an area like this, we'd want to preclude blocks and blocks and blocks of homes. So I would be voting yes on this.
Any further comments? The clerk will call the roll on the -2 amendments.
Ackerman?
No.
Greenlee?
Excused.
No. Anderson?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Sumner?
Yes.
Chair Barrett?
Chair votes aye. The -2 amendments are adopted to House Bill 3312, and the chair would seek a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3312 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson has moved House Bill 3312 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Ackerman?
No.
Reba?
Excused?
No.
Anderson? Yes.
Smith?
Aye.
Sumner?
Yes.
Chair Barrett?
The chair votes aye. House Bill 3312, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we will close the work session. On the House Bill 3312, Representative Anderson, would you like to carry this bill?
I will.
Representative Anderson will be the carrier. Committee, we were not here. House Bill 2956. House Bill 2162, the in essence gut and stuff that we are waiting to hear about before we consider reconsideration. Those amendments are not available yet, but will be available on Friday.
No, I can't hear you.
Okay.
I can hear you.
I'll wait till the room closes. Please clear the room if you're not going to stay in the room.
Yeah, please want to have a conversation somewhere else.
Committee, we are not
not going to hear, 2956. House Bill 2162 is in the process of being amended. Those amendments are not ready yet. When they are, we will have the proponent bring them forward so that we can decide as to whether we want possible reconsideration of 2162. I don't see any sense in hearing it today and then hearing it again on Friday. So we won't hear that one today either. So seeing no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.